Morning!
Morning!
Welcome to the India Explained podcast, recorded in London and San Francisco. One take, unscripted, no rehearsal.
Hey Bunty, welcome back. Welcome back to listeners. So for our other episode today, we thought we'd do something, you know, suggestion that you had, Bunty. It's an excellent suggestion on the role and the value of transparency in governance, especially in times of crisis like this. And the framing question which you articulated is that, you know, countries like the US and UK, which for whatever faults and whatever, you know, bungling may have happened, have been relatively transparent about measures taken, right? So if they underplayed the threat earlier, it was all out there and they had a range of reactions from the press. If they overplayed the threat, that's been there. You know, Trump's been making a mess of things here, but, you know, whatever he said is out there. It's being criticized by the press. I know there's, you know, animated debates between epidemiologists, health professionals, econometricians, because apparently a lot of the models used by epidemiologists use these, you know, econometric modeling techniques and so on, or, you know, mathematical techniques of the kind that econometricians use. There's a healthy, vibrant discourse, even if the policy isn't always sound. Compare this, as you pointed out, to the, you know, Chinese government's initial lack of transparency and really going after the whistleblower, that poor 32-year-old doctor from Wuhan who was silenced when he raised the alarm, and he tragically died of the virus, and Japan kind of hedging its bets about, you know, the Olympics, etc. So, yeah, that's the framing question. So what are your thoughts about it, like moving ahead?
I think, you know, that puts us in a very, that is exactly the fault line, Rohit. You know, we have got, this is a problem, a challenge that is facing every country, right?
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to see how different countries are approaching this and what it shows in their psyche. Right.
Yeah.
We will come to India because I think in many ways India's response to this has been remarkable up until now.
Yeah.
Right. So, and I mean that in a positive way, right? Not in a negative way.
Yeah.
I think, but okay, let's take the first thing. I'm qualified to talk about the UK because, you know, I'm living here and I'm consuming news here. In the UK, people have been, government and government policy has been very transparent, and it has also done a couple of U-turns. In the last 4 weeks. So initially the plan was we were not going to be social isolating, we were just going to be building herd immunity. Because the truth was, UK was saying that, you know, there's no way on God's earth that in an active liberal democracy, you can practice the level of isolation, deterministic isolation, or, you know, policed isolation that states like China can, right? It just doesn't, the freedom, even with life at threat, it doesn't allow itself. Then there was a change of heart because people realized that, hang on, so that's just one part of the equation. The other part of the equation was if you have 100 hospital beds, surely the game plan has to be to ensure that you don't have 101 patients at any given point in time. And then the argument became that in order to ensure that we can protect health of people with our national resources, we would urge a lockdown. So the messaging was initially was that, you know, we continue with life as it is, and the lockdown, we will, there's no need to lockdown like Sweden. Like Sweden is practicing what we were thinking originally of. There's no need to lockdown. If you fall in, you'll come to the hospital, we'll treat you because we have capacity. UK suddenly realized that capacity is there, but not infinite. And the growth rate in UK, etc., because, you know, we haven't clamped down international travel, none of that sort of things have happened. So people from infected parts of the world, where there's high rates of infection, can still swan into the UK, right? But the argument was that you stay at home so that if there are 100 beds in hospital, we would try and like to have the infection levels to 90, right? So there's a 10% buffer. That's roughly the logic. In the US, I think the president made certain noises, and correct me if I'm wrong, but essentially the mandate, the power is held by different state governors. They decide what happens in the local areas. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely right. It's, you know, the model of American federalism. There are some nationwide directives, but they are, you know, at the order of directives. I don't think you can enforce orders. And it's been the same thing with questions of reopening. And that's, you know, been both a good thing and a bad thing, where governors who've been proactive, like, you know, Governor Newsom of California, I think we've done well in California. whereas there have been some other states. Florida has reopened, and within a day of its opening, the beaches have been absolutely packed. But I think they will see some kind of surge in deaths.
Right. So the reason we talk about the UK and the US, countries we live in, contrast that with China and Japan. Two cases in point. And there's also Korea and Taiwan in the neighborhood.
Right.
So China, the disease happens in China, it's detected. China then creates a witch hunt against people who've detected it, which is unfortunate. And recently it comes to light that the number of people who've died in Wuhan are double the number of people that were actually declared initially, right? Mm-hmm. Which puts into credibility, questions the credibility of the Chinese state, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of truth-telling, right? And truth-telling at a very basic human level, that people are real and people are dying. This is not about fudging your growth numbers or, you know, promising that, you know, you will grow faster as an economy at a future point, because those are like chukki tales. Anybody, any government does that, right? Japan, on the other hand, very different tactic. It pretended nothing was going on, and Japan was above and over and above all of this. Till such time, the Olympics were being held. Right? The moment the Olympics got cancelled, COVID naturally became... COVID cases started declaring themselves, and there was a state of national emergency, right? Mm-hmm. So two separate points there. The Chinese lie was that it is happening, but I'm going to lie about it. Mm-hmm. The Japanese lie is that it's not happening till such time it's convenient for it to happen, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And these are cultures. One's in a kind of one-party communist state, or, you know, the other one is a functioning democracy, right? Mm-hmm. Now, juxtapose this with India, right? I think we have been doing remarkably well up until now in terms of urging people. I mean, I think one of the mishandlings was not giving people enough notice, because Modi has a tendency of kind of grandstanding and shocking the nation into instant action, which the comfortable middle classes can manage, but the working poor and the day laborers are kind of impacted by. So that wasn't taken into account, but the principles of getting a nation of 1.3 billion people to lockdown for a period of 40 days now, right, and it's ongoing, is remarkable to see that with, because if there is general disobedience, right, amongst the populace, no amount of policing or military presence can help stop people from, you know, going about their daily lives. Because over here, breaking the law, essentially, a very low-grade activity. Like, by stepping out to buy 6 eggs, you are actually breaking the law, right? Mm-hmm. Now, at a human-to-human basis, enforcing that in a hugely punitive manner, unless you're North Korea, is very difficult. You will not be sent to a labor camp because you went out to buy 6 eggs, right? Mm-hmm. So when you start thinking of that in the Indian context, I think we're doing phenomenally well for a population as large and diverse as our country, how, up until now, how the line is being held. What is your view?
Well, you know, I think it's, you raise very good points, and I think there's a lot we don't know right now. To me, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, once we have better estimates from the world over, if we have a kind of, you know, model that has a high degree of accuracy, what the rate of infection is, what the rate of asymptomatic carriers are, and so on. Also, to me, there's a very interesting question here about what may be called heterogeneities, which is that, you know, in India, for instance, I just read a story today saying that something like 75 to 80% of all carriers may be, sorry, all people infected may be asymptomatic. In the US, Hawaii has had very low rates of infection. Now, they have been proactive, but even given their level of being proactive compared to other states that have done the same, they've had much lower. So I would think much lower rates of infection. And there's been, you know, the hospitals haven't been overwhelmed, which is a good thing because Hawaii doesn't have, you know, that many ventilators or emergency room beds and so on. So I think, yes, big shout out to several, you know, Indian initiatives. I think the first one is that, you know, the state of Kerala, which was one of the first places affected, they did a fantastic job. And I think, you know, in the last few years, there have been times when the BJP government has kind of, you know, gone after Kerala in all kinds of ways. And there's a long-standing kind of fight there between the RSS and the right. But I think they have learned the right lessons from Kerala. And Kerala also had experience with doing this with things like controlling the Nipah virus and so on. I know that, you know, when they find something that's a hot spot, they immediately put the whole area into quarantine. I know my parents' apartment complex where they live in Pune is doing a fantastic job. So all of that is very good. Now, the question is that these, and I think part of the worry also is they don't want it spreading to the rural areas. For me, the two sort of missing questions, and here I will say that the same concerns we have about lack of transparency in a place like China and Japan also for me do apply a little bit to India, because I know that at the beginning of this crisis, Modi called all the editors of different newspapers in and said, don't be negative in your coverage. And that's basically code for saying that if you criticize the government, we're going to come after you. I mean, we have enough evidence to know that that's how this government functions. So the question now for me is that, you know, India has a fairly, you know, poor record when it comes to some, you know, aspects of public health, TB, etc. Many of those populations are already vulnerable. So a lot of the deaths that may be occurring, you know, of people who are immunocompromised, are we counting those as coronavirus deaths, right? And I think the lack of clarity about what's been going on with the population of migrant labor, to me, that is very disturbing, because there isn't really as much work going on journalistically as there should. I know that, you know, The Wire, which is run, one of the founders and editors, Siddharth Vardarajan, he's been threatened with arrest by the UP government. And it's serious enough where, you know, something like 22,000 people from The World have signed a petition. And I just got an email from, you know, Raghu Karnad, who's one of the other, you know, founding editors, editor at large, talking about this kind of witch hunt. Because what The Wire has been doing is it's been talking about precisely these kind of both undemocratic and, you know, in some ways, initiatives that violate human rights, initiatives that the state governments have been doing. So that's kind of my picture. I think, you know, the response is varied. MP is not doing a good job, because Indore is obviously a place which is impacted quite severely. But some places which have got their act together have done a very good job in India, no question.
Yeah, right. Well, look, it's a mixed bag. We wanted to talk about the issues of, you know, different countries. And I think Russia is coming tiptoeing into the framework now, because initially Putin classified it as a bit of a flu and people were overreacting. Yeah. Now the Russian cases are rising, so it will be seen. And, you know, Russia as a country has an immense appetite for willful, wanton death and destruction of its own people, right? Yeah. It has a history is littered with occasions where it has willfully put its own citizens in harm's way for some kind of national narrative. I think it will be very interesting to see how it pans out in Russia. I think some of the countries in the European Union are trying to normalize this. Some of them, like I think Austria and Switzerland, have started saying that you guys can go back to normal life. Sweden never left normal life, Sweden and Norway, some of the Scandinavian countries. But they are kind of, with their population sizes and their advanced healthcare kind of provisioning, they probably could have got away with that. I think the test case will be how many people are affected in a country, 300 million people in the United States. And, you know, some of the kind of, basically the democracies, Western democracies, which have large populations, and not an advanced enough healthcare system. That's going to be the challenge. I'm completely at a blind spot on South America and Africa, how COVID-19 is going to impact those countries. Because at the moment, it seems like a disease that has predominantly been home game in the European Union and ASEAN countries and China and United States. Only time will tell.
I mean, I don't know much about, I know Brazil has not, you know, again, their health minister was fired because Bolsonaro, who's kind of a dictator himself, again, has had a kind of very bad, you know, and a silly reaction to it. Africa, many countries are in a bad state. You know, South Sudan has, I think, no ventilators or maybe two, and some countries have none. But yeah, you know, we just hope for the best, and, you know, I'm still optimistic on the whole. And, you know, so far, at least, I just hope that what's being done in India to protect the middle classes is what should be done to protect the population at large. I think, you know, I don't want to be this sort of doomsayer, naysayer, running down, you know, anything that state governments or the federal government are doing. This is, you know, but I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that in every country, a couple of things, in a number of countries, a couple of things have happened. And Modi was featured in an article which said that there are five countries where democratic rights might be rolled back and they may be used by leaders to consolidate power even when, you know, the threat of the virus subsides. And India is one of them, Hungary is another. So that is the concern I have. I want to just end, I will give you the final word on this because I want, you know, I want to share a concern and just get your perspective. Yogendra Yadav made an interesting point on television. My mom was telling me. He said that the Indian government is currently, you know, it's doing stuff to, I think, get Indian students who are stranded abroad back home. And that's wonderful. But he said, you're taking so much effort for Indian citizens, Indian students who are in other countries, and you're completely abandoning, you know, the poor who are at your doorstep, right? People who are homeless themselves. And I you know, something about that really has you know, got me thinking, and it's shaken me a bit also. So, you know, what are your thoughts as we move towards wrapping this up?
Well, I think, you know, my thoughts are no different to yours. I think in India, as in any part of the world, the starting point should be all lives matter equally. But the truth is that certain lives matter more than others. I think it's only a matter of time before, you know, I think when the rubber meets the road and if where this infection takes widespread hold in India, that is when the policy making and the government crisis handling will be truly tested, because those, at the moment, what you're doing is you're prioritizing movement of people between abroad to home or from one region of the country to the other. In the scheme of things, it's kind of starter set. The trouble begins when you have to make these decisions with, you know, who lives and who dies, who gets health provision, who doesn't. And I hope that India doesn't have to get into, or the state doesn't have to get into those kind of decision-making. Because, you know, I completely take your point that, you know, if you're a student abroad, coming back home as opposed to migrant labor in Delhi, each of those journeys are equally important, and the government should do to ensure that everybody is treated equally. But I think the bigger story is, if there are 200 beds in India and people need help, who is the government going to provide the help to? Is it going to be the deserving or to the person who can afford it? That scares me, because an Indian system runs on who can pay most. And I was having a discussion with another friend saying that it could literally become Hunger Games, which is essentially you've got one bed and two people try to bid to get onto that bed. So this kind of whole ruthless thing of, you know, because you know how medicine works in India, that, you know, if you pay for it, you get it, but what happens if somebody pays more for it, right? And that is what freaks me out. Not at this stage in terms of movement and mobility and containment, but if the infection takes hold, how do you prioritize? Will India have the humanity to treat all lives with equal value? That's the big question, right? I think that will be the challenge.
And we don't have that in normative time. So the question is, can this be an occasion where, you know, we can tap into culturally whatever aspect of our society has had that, and that compassion can, you know, this can be a transformative moment in terms of how we think about our fellow citizens. All right, so I think we'll wrap it up on that note, and thanks to our listeners, and take care, man. We'll be back soon chatting.
Chalo, take care, boss. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to us. Rohit and Bunty would like to sign off. Please stay tuned. Follow us on India Explained on Twitter. Keep listening. Thank you for all your support.